This episode of Above and Beyond is sponsored by Compassion International. To sponsor a child today, simply visit compassion.com/above.
Cairo, Seattle.
Here comes your way, the second to last episode of podcast season number one of Above and Beyond. And Ian's going to step a long snapper. Yeah, a long snapper. We've had them all in season one of Above and Beyond, haven't we? Coaches, quarterbacks, Hall of Fame receivers. And in steps Clint Gresham, a six-year NFL vet, a Super Bowl champion with the Seattle Seahawks. And I got to know Clint a number of years ago. We did some speaking events together. He has a heart for the Lord. He had a heart for the Lord when he donned that Seahawk uniform. And I would always remember watching him and praying for him and rooting him on and looking at, here's Clint Gresham in this rough and tumble NFL. And here's a guy that's serving the Lord and living for the Lord and just so happy for him and wanting it badly to be back in the NFL, as I'm going to share with him here in just a bit, with a career that to me was cut short. But on the inside, not only inside of those walls, but on the inside of Clint's heart was a feeling of inadequacy, a feeling of insecurity, a feeling of brokenness, a feeling of never feeling like you quite belonged, which I find incredibly beautiful because I too struggled with many of those same things. Living in a world of the NFL and all this testosterone and all this competitiveness, and yet many times feeling like you didn't belong. How do you walk that? Many of you I know have inadequacies and insecurities, and whether you're going to share with them, as Clint is going to do in this podcast, it is done in his new book called Becoming, which you can find on Amazon, and I encourage you to do so. Well, that's on your plate. But Clint Gresham is going to share his story, all of it, from the inside out. I know a bit about you. I don't know the beginnings, I don't think.
I grew up going to church. I grew up in Texas, which meant you had to go to church if you wanted to fit in because it's such a part of the culture down there. And I think I was like a lot of people that thought that God was kind of this mostly frustrated grandpa that was irritated a lot of the time. He kind of put up with me, but he was mostly frustrated. Which led to this sense of performance, which was already hitting a bunch of things that were in my heart because I was involved in sports. And, you know, when you play well, you get praised and you get love and you get affirmation. And if you're like so many athletes, you know, who are in a place that maybe aren't receiving the kind of love and affirmation that they need. I mean, so many guys that we played with came from really broken homes and homes that were void of love, that didn't have a father in it. So a sport becomes a pseudo father because a father gives identity and affirmation and love, and a sport does that. It makes you perform for it, and which is twisted. And so I felt like that was kind of how God was with me, that I was having to jump through these hoops. And as long as I was doing good, he liked me, but most of the time I wasn't quite good enough. And it wasn't until I got into college and had a really radical encounter with God that got a hold of my heart. And I had a mentor who was just available for me. And when life was falling apart, I would give him a call. He's actually the guy that I dedicated my book to. He was my second cousin and a spiritual father to me and a spiritual father to a ton of people. And it's kind of actually this beautiful serendipitous thing. He actually passed away on Father's Day last year. And so, yeah, I think it was a gradual process, but kind of once I had somebody who was literally just available for me and was on my team and walked me through those moments, did I start to understand that the God of the Bible is different than the God that I had believed in for so long.
You're sitting in a seat where Steve Largent, Hall of Famer Steve Largent, said exactly to that point. Some of the anger, some of the rage, some of the unforgiveness in his life was the fuel for his sport. That he said, without that, I don't think I'm not paraphrasing, so I don't think I'd have been a Hall of Famer had I not had some of that brokenness that he had grown up to fuel him as an athlete and as a competitor. What fueled you? If you were in church, you were hearing scripture, you were in the Bible Belt, what fueled Clint Gresham, the person and the athlete growing up?
It was the identity. I had no clue who I was, and it made me a very insecure, fragile guy. And I would say that that lasted pretty much until I got released by the Seahawks. And I think that it's inevitable. You know, sports are wonderful. They're incredible for the development of young people across the world. They're terrible fathers and they're terrible religions. And we make them those things, which is unfortunate. But because I had such a low sense of self-worth, I tried really, really hard in sports because the harder I tried, the more affirmation that I got and the more sense of significance I felt. And then all of a sudden, I've got, you know, D1 schools that want to bring me in. And now all of a sudden, like, people know who I am. And that is addictive to people who don't know who they are. And so that was really my drive. And once I got into the locker room, when you start hearing stories from guys, like, it's normally coming from this place of this chip on the shoulder, which, if you just peeled it back a little bit more, is a profound place of brokenness. And I've realized that a lot of high performers, the reason that they don't want to go there with stuff like this is because they think that it's actually going to neuter their performance in their sport or in their job or whatever it is. If I open up my heart and kind of get some healing in these areas of brokenness, I'm not going to have that fight anymore. And that's a terribly fearful situation because you want to perform, you want to be great, you want to be all about what you're doing, but if you think that that's going to make you lose your edge, it's scary to go there.
Where was mom, dad, family, brothers, friends as you're walking that?
They were all really, really supportive. My parents got divorced when I was 8. And so obviously brokenness comes from that. And my parents did a really wonderful job of a challenging situation of raising both my brother and I. I think that anybody that has walked through a divorce, it's always going to be messy. And there's always going to be this sense of, you know, like, what could have been. But I always knew that, like, my parents loved me and they supported me.
Create that insecurity, though? Build on insecurities at that age?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was already a very sensitive guy. And I think that that has been a gift and a curse for me in a lot of ways. It made me not really feel like I fit in sometimes in certain areas, like especially in the locker room where it's just like such this bravado culture. And I'm like, dude, how's your heart? And like, they're like, what the hell are you talking about, man? Like, nobody wants to go there, you know? But that's just kind of how I've been wired. But as far as like connecting with people, it has been the greatest gift of my life because like I can understand like what people are walking through.
I've gotten to share a stage with you a couple times, heard some of your testimony. So as you mentioned, there were a lot of, you had multiple D1 offers, chance to go different places. Why and how TCU?
I went to the University of Oklahoma first. They came in about October of my senior year of high school, and I went to one game there. I mean, it's like, these people are gods. These players are gods, literally. And like, you have thousands of people that are just obsessed with this moment, and it's intoxicating.
Did you stay at that hotel by campus that has the red carpet, all the pictures? What was the name of that? I got sicker than a dog in that hotel. But literally, every room is a shrine to one of their great players. They have an Adrian Peterson room, all of their great Sam Bradford room, literally.
That's so ridiculous. And the room is nothing but pictures. That's so ridiculous.
And the carpets are all like shag carpet. They're all red.
Yeah.
It is where like a lot of the former players come in. They have big parties there. It's right next to, it's kind of on the main drag by their football stadium. But you mentioned gods. Yes, they adore in the shrines and the idols to some of those players there. It was remarkable.
Yeah, they're just very upfront with their idolatry.
Yes, yes. You went there, and that's where you originally committed and went?
I went there. TCU came, you know, after signing day and said, we want to give you a scholarship. And this was after 4 months of being gung-ho Oklahoma. So I'm like, man, you guys showed up way too late. And I went to Oklahoma, and I had a horrible experience there. And I was a really broken, insecure kid and struggled with substance abuse while I was there. And it was not a good experience. And they told me that they were going to put me on scholarship after a semester. Of course, that didn't happen. And so they said, we want to see you in January. We want to see you through spring ball. We want to see you through summer workouts. We want to see you through a season. They just kind of kept stringing me along with that. And I was seeing in the newspaper that the coaches were telling the media, we don't have a long snapper here and we need to go out and find somebody. Mm-hmm. So I finally decide, I think that my time here needs to end. And thankfully, TCU and Gary Patterson still had a place for me, and it was the best decision I could have made, and got to be a part of some incredible years at TCU, you know, as they were, you know, launching out into this incredible place. And that was a challenging season, but it was also really, really good for me to get out of that situation.
You said insecure and broken a number of times already here, like in the first 10 minutes. Did you know that then when you were 18, 19? Did you know you were broken? Did you know you had deep insecurities?
I was so good at hiding. Man, I was good at hiding. And at least to myself, I'm sure that everybody around me was like, dude, this guy is a mess. It's like, it's obvious to everybody else in the room except for me. Yeah. And I think that that's usually how it goes. And we deceive ourselves very, very well. And we have this tendency to lie to ourselves. And even if you think that you have it all together, I think the greatest thing that you can do for yourself is to do some introspection and identify, like, where are some areas in my life where I'm afraid to go, I'm afraid to be vulnerable, I'm afraid to let people see. Identify those areas where you may be placing too much of your sense of identity. And usually the thing that tries to pull for our identity the most is the thing that makes us feel the most significant. That's always where we try and get our identity from. And if you can have the courage to at least look at that, you're going to be a much more stable person throughout your life.
Well, I can't wait to dig into how we walk that, because then ultimately, how do you walk it as a competitor? How do you live mm-hmm. that? But as you lied in that bed in that dorm room in Oklahoma, battling, as you said, substance abuse and just brokenness and emptiness, as you lied there at night, did you know that he had more for you than this?
I believed that God loved me. And I had moments throughout my life where, like, man, I'd be in tears. And this is before I had really even started having much of an interest of God, but just having moments where, like, man, like, God is real and God loves me.
Can you remember some of those?
Yeah, my freshman year, I watched that video. It's like Rick Hoyt.
Pushing his son.
And it was paired with that song, My Redeemer Lives. And it's just the most beautiful picture of, you know, what God does for us, that, man, we can't do anything on our own. And, man, I even, like, tear up in this moment right now just thinking about that, of being in a dorm room and feeling so isolated and alone and insecure and feeling like I don't have what it takes. And then even in that, like, even in my rebellion, even in my really trying to get these needs met in the only way that I knew how, which was, you know, through all the things that the world had to offer, like, even in that, like, God liked me. And that's an offensive thing to religious people, you know, that even in your sin, like, God enjoys you. He likes you. He's not disgusted with you. And I can count on all of these moments throughout my life where God seemed to have been just depositing, like, I know that you're struggling. I know you feel alone. I know you feel ashamed. And even right now, you hate yourself. But even in that, I just want you to know that I'm for you and that I have a plan for your life.
And the door opens to TCU.
And that continued to be kind of my story. I still struggled and was in a relationship with somebody. And it wasn't until really my senior year that ended up ending this relationship. And right after that, and I took a discipleship class at a church for a month. And it essentially taught disciplines for what it means to be a follower of Jesus. And so, like, you would have a 2-hour class on a Sunday. You had to go to church twice a week. You could only watch or listen to 2 hours of secular media a week. You had to read your Bible every day, journal every day about it, listen to 3 hours worth of teaching throughout the week. No dating activity. And it basically just stripped away any type of worldly influence you could have and flooded you with the Word of God. And that was for a month. And it radically changed my life. radically changed my life. And that was 8 years ago. And that month, I still feel like who I am today is a direct result of a month that I took of pursuing God and stripping away all of these areas and that we look to that the world offers. And by having that concentrated effort, it changed me and marked me forever. And I went back for my senior year at TCU and had a wonderful experience there. And I believe that that season prepared me for my time in the NFL. I usually tell guys, if you don't know who you are coming into the NFL, you're going to struggle. If you don't know where your identity comes from, it's too alluring to come into the NFL and everything that comes with that to not begin to place your sense of significance in what that brings. And so thankfully, Jesus got a hold of my heart before I got into the NFL. And so even in moments when I struggled in my time with the Seahawks, I was able to trace it back to, but this is who I am. This is who God says that I am.
Bedrock.
Bedrock.
And then ultimately your first round pick of the Seahawks, they take you 18 overall.
Yes, yes. I flew to New York, gave Roger Goodell a big old hug.
Huge hug.
Gosh, he picked me up off the ground. It was uncomfortable,
first
actually.
First long snapper ever drafted in the first round of the NFL, right? Yeah. How did that door open with the Seahawks?
I thought that I was going to be drafted. When I was in high school, it was my dream to play for the Houston Texans. I grew up 4 hours south of Houston. I told all my friends in high school that one day I'm going to go be the long snapper for the Texans. And I go to the NFL scouting combine. I was the only long snapper invited to the combine. And the Texans were talking to me the most, more than any other team. And I'm kind of like playing out in my head, like, you know, delight yourself in the Lord and God gives you what you want.
Yes.
isn't that how that verse goes?
Right.
And, you know, I had people coming up to me and saying, like, Clint, you're the best long snapper we've seen in 10 years, which is sort of like saying, Clint, out of all the hobbits in the land, you're the tallest. Like, there's nobody taller than you, Clint Gresham. And so, like, I appreciate that. There's not a whole lot of glamour in what I do. So, thank you, though. I also realized that what they were doing by saying that was trying to assure me that if we don't draft you, you're still going to sign as a free agent, which is what happened. So, yeah. I don't get drafted. Everything in the natural looks like I'm supposed to go to Houston. They were giving me almost three times the amount of money what any other team was offering. It was my dream. It was a guarantee. They were getting rid of their long snapper. And as I was on the phone with my mentor, the guy that I dedicated my book to, we were praying about it. And I felt like I had this statement pop into my mind. And it was, who's the only team in the nation whose name points to me, whose name speaks of me? And at this point, I had five teams who were interested in me: the Texans, the Chiefs, the Ravens, the Saints, and the Dolphins. And I thought about it, and it's the Saints. And I realized that's kind of this funny, obscure play on words, but God has done weirder stuff in the Bible that worked out for the people who did that.
Yeah.
And so I go to New Orleans, and it was one of the darkest experiences of my life. I sacrificed a dream and a guarantee to step out on this word from the Lord. And I go down there and I've never felt more alone, more isolated, more on the fringe, like I didn't belong. And I've never felt closer to Jesus, because it forced me into a deep relationship with God where it's like, man, I have to spend time with God, because if I don't, like, I'm done. Like, I feel so alone here. And after 3 months, I got a knock on my door one morning, and it's a scout, and the scout for the Saints says, hey, Coach Payton wants to talk to you. And I'm like, oh, good. I actually had some thoughts that I wanted to run past him. Saw some things with Drew Brees' throwing mechanics I just want to work on. I think with my help, we can help him go far. He's got a future in this league.
Right.
And so I have no clue that—
You had no clue. Huh?
I had no clue.
Really?
I was like, why does he want to talk to me? And I'm like walking into the slaughterhouse. And he sits me down and he lets me know that, hey, we just signed our first round pick. We don't have room for you. And I'm now unemployed. And so I'm driving back to Fort Worth, Texas. And I have 7 hours to think about how I screwed up my life, how I just ruined this whole thing. I had the guarantee, and everybody told me I was nuts for doing this, and I'm thinking, like, man, I can go back to working valet. I made 10 bucks an hour doing that until I figure out what's going to be next. And 24 hours later, I get a call from the Seahawks, and they say, Clint, we've claimed your contract. We have a flight for you tonight and first class for practice tomorrow morning. Like, can you be there? And I'm like, well, you know, I got this car parking thing going on. It's pretty lucrative. I know Pete Carroll wants me to come, but I got a $5 tip the other day. And, man, I come to Seattle, and it, you know, we end up being the only team in NFL history to win our division with a losing record. And the team that we beat in the first round of the playoffs was the defending Super Bowl champions, the New Orleans Saints, the team that cut me. Wow. Like, vengeance is mine, says the Lord.
That's right. And before we go further, can you please take me to that 7-hour drive from New Orleans back to Houston after you've been cut, after you felt like, hey, Lord, I'm following your will here, and then it's pulled from underneath me. Can you, if I'm sitting passenger shotgun in your truck, tell me about what's going on.
I think that God allows in his wisdom what he could prevent in his power. And the only way that we grow is through those dark moments that are challenging. And I'm sitting in my car thinking that I've ruined my life. God, I did what you said. It made no sense. Everybody thought I was crazy. I look like a moron for doing this thing. And where are you? You know, that seems to be the question of all of our hearts. Like, God, are you even here? Are you as aware of how I'm feeling right now as I am? It doesn't feel like it. And it was this wrestling and having to go back to what he says about who he is rather than what my limited understanding is about his will for my life. And I look at where my life has come since then. Had there been no New Orleans, there would be no Seattle. Had I leaned on my own understanding and did what seemed right by going to Houston, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today.
You're screaming out to God in that drive? Are you calling your friend? You have cell phones, right? This isn't that long ago. So you had cell phone, right?
Yes.
Are you calling your mentor? Are you screaming? Are you crying? Are you blaring music with Metallica with your windows rolled down? What are we doing?
I called my mentor and pretty much just called all the people that had been speaking into my life up until that point. And I was blasting worship music, trying to counteract all of the thoughts of doubt and defeat that I was feeling. I knew that if I don't get disciplined a little bit in my thinking, my brain's going to take me to a dark spot. And I know that I've been in that dark spot before, so I need to be careful with this. Mm. And so it was really trying to be disciplined with my words and how I spoke and just my thoughts. And a lot of that was because I had people who were speaking into my life who were giving me a sense of hope that I know this doesn't make sense right now. It will.
God allows in his wisdom what he could prevent with his power.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Is that in your book here? Is this in Becoming?
That is in my book. Huh? Yeah.
Where is that counsel from? In seriousness, God allows in his wisdom what he could prevent in his power. I mean, that's all over the truth and all over the Bible, obviously.
I mean, you look at James, you know, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience.
Mm.
I hate that verse. But the reality is that if you had God's perspective about the trial that you're walking through, and you could understand that it's only in a trial that God gives you something that you otherwise wouldn't have had, that there's actually going to be some gold in this, and God's going to establish something in you that will forever impact not only your life, but anybody you come into contact with. Mm. Well, if you have that kind of perspective, it's going to make this trial, maybe it's still going to hurt, but you're also going to see that there is a gift in this. And so God allows us to go through these challenging moments because he knows what's on the other side of having to walk through a wilderness or what I call a process. Mm. You know, the process is that the time from between when God says something to when the manifestation of the promise happens, and it's that time in between that is not fun. And anybody who ever endured or did anything for God in the Bible always endured a process. Like Noah told to build an ark, like Jesus hanging on the cross, like Mary carrying a baby in a society that stoned women for what it was perceived that she had done. Like all of them endured this temporary sense of discomfort to get to something that God wanted to give them in the long run. Mm. And so if we can realize that God has got this really great track record of doing that, then it's going to give us a sense of hope and purpose, even in the middle of our pain. And it's going to help us not get blown apart when we don't get exactly what we thought we were going to be getting.
There'd have been no TCU without Oklahoma. There'd have been no Seattle Seahawks without the Saints. So you get that first class ticket. You come to Seattle. You get to be a part of this thing with Pete Carroll in this town that I live in that just absolutely exploded. What was that like?
I think that, like, looking back on it, I'm like, wow, that was way more amazing than I had any clue in the moment of. Like, I remember when the Broncos scored their first and only touchdown of the game, I'm thinking, like, here it comes. Okay, like, we got to go. And I don't even know how much we were up by at that point. Like, it didn't sink in that we were about to win the Super Bowl until, like, 2 minutes left in the game. And then even then, it was like, whoa, we won the Super Bowl. And then coming back to Seattle, and there's like a million people in the streets and going through the Super Bowl parade. Like, it was such a crazy, unbelievable moment. And I have such a profound sense of gratitude of having the opportunity to be here, like right on the cusp of Pete building this thing and then it turning into what it was. And so much of who he is has influenced who I am today. And it was an unbelievable experience and opportunity to get to be a part of it.
So you call it a process. Out of Clint Gresham, who goes, you know, and I love some of these pictures and images and the broken and the insecure and then gaining counsel and having wisdom poured into your life. And then having now the NFL, man, and being single and having success and getting a second contract and everything that the NFL throws your way. How did Clint Gresham intersect that faith that you are now walking with sport at the highest of levels and the highest of fame and attention?
I felt lucky because I created a life outside of football, because like football is, it's not the real world. It's a unique subculture that is really, really cool, but it's not reality. And so I really made this concentrated effort to do something apart from this so that I had a sanctuary to go back to refill. And so I was living on Mercer Island with five other guys, and we were all doing Young Life, which is a ministry that has a huge part of my heart. And I think that because when I would leave work at 3:30, 4 o'clock, I mean, I'd be going straight to a high school football practice after that and just giving my life away. And it made the NFL not feel like the only thing that I had. And it made me feel like I had a purpose that's more than just throwing a football between my legs. Throwing the football between my legs gave me a voice into the lives of all of these young people that I mentored and discipled over the last, 6 years that I was in Seattle. But yeah, because I had a life outside of football, I felt like I could handle this.
How about life inside that bubble? Because you're right. When I look back on it, and I'll say a lot of times on my radio show, it's not their fault. You're just in a bubble. My wife, and we got married right at the end of college. And it was awesome. So we walked this whole journey together. And we look back at it now like, man, we're such a bubble. It just was not reality. That NFL world and perspective was so different. How did you walk that inside those walls?
I felt really insecure. A lot of it just because the nature of my position was, if I snap a ball here, nobody knows who I am. If the ball is 6 inches higher, I'm such a failure. And walking into this room where I have such a unique position, I felt that sense of failure a lot. And I felt like people were mostly frustrated with me. And so that kind of got into my head a little bit, especially like my last couple of years. And so I really struggled my last couple of years with the team, just with my own sense of self-esteem and carrying myself with confidence. And so I don't think that I'm thankful that I had the life outside of football, because it allowed me to get back to something and it allowed me to be in the NFL for longer than I think I would have been had I only had football. But the actual day-to-day stuff, I really just tried to focus on what my job was and trying to reach out to guys and let them know about this God that I serve. And but it was challenging at times.
You know, what's pretty beautiful about this, and what I really appreciate, Clint, is I'm hearing that even as you're walking with the Lord, and I think this is an important message, I feel you and I hear this of even as you're walking with the Lord and serving Him and giving your life, you are still battling insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
You are still battling some of those things in that room, that your life isn't perfect, that you give your life to the Lord and you're walking faithfully, and yet you still had insecurities in that profession. That's a powerful message to hear. I think a lot of times, think, okay, if I got enough faith, then these little thoughts are out.
Oh, man.
Right? If I got a God big enough in my life, then these insecurities and worries and fears, they're gone. They're not. You won a Super Bowl. You played 6 years in the league. You long snapped in Super Bowls, two of them. And yet those fears and those insecurities still rumbled.
Yeah, man. Winning a Super Bowl didn't make my feelings of inadequacy go away. Like, what a joke. I remember our very first meeting back after winning the Super Bowl, or I guess it was our exit meeting. You know, somebody comes up to the front and says, unless you win two Super Bowls, you haven't done anything. And I'm like, man, that's the most offensive thing I've ever heard. Like, we're 36 hours after winning the Super Bowl. Like, let us have this for a second. But like, I realized like what he was trying to say with that. But it doesn't make us satisfied. It really doesn't. And I remember for the months after we won, guys kept saying, I keep waiting for it to sink in that we won the Super Bowl. I said that a lot. And what I realized all of us meant by that was, I keep waiting for this thing to satisfy me the way that I thought it would, and it doesn't. And I'm really bummed about that because I thought it was going to make me feel awesome. And it's amazing. We won a Super Bowl. It's great. It for sure does not make all of my insecurities go away. It does not make me feel like I'm bulletproof now. If I try and put my sense of significance and value in something like that, I'm going to have a very fragile life. I'm going to have a very fragile ego. Like, ultimately, anything that we put our sense of value in that can be taken away from us is going to make a life that is unstable, because this is why God tells us, I want you to dig down deep and build your life upon the rock, and don't build your life upon the sand. Building your life upon the sand is, my sense of value comes from, I have this many zeros, you know, in my bank account, or I have this many letters behind my name, and all of the areas that we try and, you know, get our sense of esteem from. And they never satisfy us like we hoped that they would.
You get to a second Super Bowl. You guys are right there on the cusp of doing what one of your teammates wanted it to do and demanded it to do. And I'm going to guess, Clint, that even if he won that second Super Bowl, even that too wouldn't have filled that hole.
Yeah.
And then how do you find yourself out of the NFL? I, for one, had a radio show in that year that after you had left, I was in this market clamoring, like, come on now. It, you know, and not to throw that current long snapper under the bus at that point, but come on. Where is, I'm not understanding this. Someone's got to explain this to me. I think even the professor, John Clayton's like, I don't get it. But also, too, Clint Gresham never missed these snaps. Like, I found myself, like, banging the table for a long snapper, yeah. Not only because I loved you and your heart and your mission and your ministry, but it just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I felt a lot of love from, you know, the Seahawks fans, and you know, I'd get hundreds of messages on social media every game of people wishing that I was back. And I was surprised.
Can you take me back? You brought up the scout with the Saints who called and said, hey, yeah, come in. Can you take me back to the time?
I was in the middle of a golf lesson because I'm terrible at golf, and I looked down at my phone, and it's the middle of March, and I see John Schneider's name pop up on my phone. And I think to myself, it's not a good thing when you have 2 years left on your contract and the general manager is calling you in March. I don't think he's calling to give me an extension or anything like that. And so I let it go to voicemail, iced him a little bit. And because this is going to be on my terms if you're going to fire me. As I call him back and, you know, he lets me know, Clint, we found somebody else and we want to go younger. We wanted to give you time to get on with another team and we wish you all the best. And I thanked him, and I thanked Coach Carroll for the opportunity. It was my dream from the time I was in high school to play for Pete Carroll. And they kind of let me know, hey, stay ready, though. And my wife and I did. And my wife and I were living month to month in a house here in Seattle, thinking that any day I'm going to be getting a call. And it never happened. And so we finally decided that the bravest thing to do would be to move on and no longer stay in this place of limbo. And so we moved back to Texas. And because living in Seattle during football season, when all of this stuff was going on, felt a lot like driving past your ex-girlfriend's house. And she's just great. And she's got this new guy who's wonderful. Everyone in town loves him. And it was hard. It was really, really hard. And I don't think people understand the humanity behind a lot of these NFL players. It is not as glamorous as you think. For some guys, it is. I'd say that is such a minority. Like, it's just not as glamorous as you think. And so my wife and I, we moved back to Texas and tried to get on with our life. And it was ultimately a really, really great decision, but it was hard because it was the death of something. It was the death of a season of life that really was going to shape the rest of my life.
Did you know that? As you're walking through that, did you know that this was dying?
I didn't really have it settled in my heart until right at the end of that year. And there's a story about when the Seahawks actually did call me. And it is a pretty interesting story of just kind of how everything happened. But it's really only been about probably like six or seven months ago that I felt like I'm no longer that person. And the writing of the book and the speaking that I've been doing really helped fill that place. And so it didn't feel as jarring as I know it is for a lot of the guys that I played with. And I felt like I was doing a lot of the stuff that I'm doing now before I got out of the NFL. So it didn't feel like such a rocky transition. But it was challenging. And like I could have told you, man, my identity is in the Lord, brother. But man, when it actually happens, like you got to walk that out. And it's hard for anybody. And all of us are going through some type of transition. And so it takes actually spending time with God and getting in his word and finding out what he has to say about himself, understanding where our sense of significance and value comes from. And when you do that, and when you can have that deep in your heart, when the trying times come, you have something to stand on.
When that call had come, did you have closure? Or were you still entertaining the idea of possibly coming back? Or were they entertaining that idea?
They were, yeah. You know, I got the call in March, and it wasn't until probably November that I don't think I'm going to hear from them. I mean, looking back on that season, there was a lot of games where I was like, why is my phone not ringing? But the Lord knows, and it allowed me the opportunity to write this book. It gave me the emotional bandwidth to do that because I had no capacity for something like that when I was playing. I felt like I was barely hanging on when I was playing for the team.
Were there other opportunities, other teams call, any other feelers, any other workouts?
I had a couple other teams call. I went in for a few different workouts, but it's kind of one of those things like, hey, we just want to see who's out there so that we know who to call when something does happen.
Yeah.
There was probably 5 snappers that went down that year, and I didn't get calls for that, which was surprising.
The Lord was closing this door.
Yeah, the Lord closed the door. And looking back, I am so grateful for it because I'm not sure I could have done it anymore. It feels like trying to hold on to a runaway train. It really does. And everybody's just trying to hold on as tight as they can for as long as they can. But that thing is moving. And once you get thrown off, man, it's hard to get back on.
Yeah.
And trying to cling to that thing for so long was exhausting. Like this constant sense of you're only as good as your last second. It is a 24/7 job interview. Everything is being evaluated. It's exhausting. And it took away a lot of the fun for me.
Clint, how do you counsel a young athlete? As I have parents that are listening to this, and even some young athletes are listening to this. How do I counsel a parent that's got a Clint Gresham, that's got the kid with a sensitive heart, that coach that's listening right now, and he's got a Clint Gresham on his team,
mm-hmm.
who is just so sensitive, man, he's a nice kid. Yeah. And he is just so sensitive. And he just has these insecurities. How do you counsel that coach, that parent, that friend that has their Clint Gresham on their team?
I'd say meeting people at their level and finding out what people need. Always praising effort. Always praising the things that are in that athlete's control. Being cautious about, you know, really lavishing on praise when good performance happens. Because that is going to speak a message to that kid who may have a sensitive heart that I only get affirmation and love when I do good. And that's a dangerous place. And so praising the things that are in their control is going to help that a lot. And helping them to understand that they're more than what they do. I think that identity is the lens that we look at everything through. And if you can help somebody understand that you're more than just an athlete, you're more than just this or that or whatever that is, allows people the freedom to not feel like their sense of worth goes up when they play well and falls to the ground when they play bad. If their identity is built on something apart from their craft, then when the things with their craft don't go well, it's still well with their soul.
A couple of the most impactful stories inside those walls of your 6-year NFL career, and then we'll get to becoming, and then we'll get to, I promise you, this chapter. And I think it's such an awesome thing. I'm not supposed to timestamp these things, but the fact that this podcast is coming out the day that your book becomes public as well, there's just an amazing divine intervention there. But give me a couple of the most profound, faith-challenging, faith-building moments as a Seattle Seahawk.
The summer before the 2013 season, I felt like God wanted me to do this video project of interviewing guys on the team and sharing our faith. And ultimately, the reason that we do what we do is because of who Jesus is in our life. And so I had this dream of calling this thing The Making of a Champion. And so during training camp, we start filming this thing, and I'm pouring tens of thousands of dollars into this video project. All at the same time, I'm competing with another long snapper who is way better than I am. He's a better long snapper. He's more athletic. He's more handsome than I am. I mean, he should have been the guy. And all while this is going on, I'm thinking to myself, man, I really hope that I play well, because this whole thing is going to fall apart and I'm going to lose and I'm going to look like a fool. And we finished that filming. And right before the third preseason game, I get a call and the Seahawks say that, hey, we decided that we're going to extend your contract and we're letting this other guy go. And that month of doing what God told me to do and not tying my sense of happiness to the outcome that I was hoping for and just focusing on, this is what God said to do right now. So I'm just going to take my mind and I'm going to focus on that, gave me the ability to play well. And that preseason, I played pretty dang good. And that year, we launched that video, The Making of a Champion. We passed out 28,000 copies of it after one of the games. Put it up on YouTube. It's got 800,000 views now. It's probably been viewed 3-4 million times, you know, across the board. And that year, we end up actually winning the world championship. And it was kind of this unbelievably prophetic thing that, like, God was like, you guys honored me and I'm going to honor you. And that's what the Lord does. And, you know, I got the idea to call it The Making of a Champion before we had any clue of how good we were going to be. And it was just this beautiful story of doing what God said, and it worked out. But it stretched me. And there were some moments where I'm thinking, this could all go down in flames. And it's in those moments that we just have to trust and be obedient to what he said to do.
How about on the flip side? How about a painful shaping story? Obviously, the termination you talked about. Was there some of those other just kind of, oh, man, that's a tough one to walk through?
There was a lot of moments of me feeling like if I was, because I'm a Christian, I shouldn't be dealing with this. And you know, I would hear verses like, be anxious for nothing, which feels like if you have 1% anxiety, you fail. I'm not supposed to be anxious about anything. Oh my gosh, I'm so freaking anxious in this job that I have right now. I feel overwhelmed with anxiety. I'm such a failure, and all this insanely negative self-talk that comes in, and then trying to go out and throw a football perfectly between my legs and be excellent with that. And it crippled me, and I felt like such a failure. And that caused me to start to go and look to all of the areas that the world has to get a sense of comfort. And I still struggled with substance stuff and all this other stuff, because I had this profound sense of I'm failing. And because I was still like walking out and trying to get a sense of esteem, I really had a hard time. And so I can point to a whole bunch of moments of just feeling like I feel so inadequate right now. And I would say that it probably started like in 2012. I felt like, man, any day now, like they're gonna replace me. And then they gave me another contract, and I was like, man, I can't believe I tricked them for another day. Man, are they seeing what I'm seeing? Gosh, thank you, Jesus, that they can't read my thoughts. But man, like, it's like what I mentioned earlier, like God is faithful and loving to us when we don't deserve it. Like, that's his grace. Like, if it was up to me, I certainly would not have been as kind to myself. And I wasn't. I was not kind to myself. I didn't have the love of God established in my heart in such a way that I believed what he said about me. And that was something that I had to continually work out. But he's faithful.
He is faithful, and he's opened the door in your post-career life to now speaking internationally, sharing your testimony, sharing your life with others in abundant ways in ministry. And I'm looking at Becoming by Clint Gresham. Look at that.
Yeah.
Huh? Look at that.
It feels like my son.
Yeah. Loving the process to wholeness. You feel whole now?
So I define wholeness as giving up hope for a better past, relinquishing control for a perfect future, and choosing joy and courage right where your feet are. And that is a process. But it's a mindset that if you can make that your aspirational pursuit, you're really going to enjoy your life a lot more. Once I got out of the NFL, I felt like it provided the opportunity to go on a journey and kind of get down deep into those dark parts of my soul that I was able to shove down and ignore with my job, with my career. And I could stuff that down and look the part and look like I had it all together, because I kind of had to look like I had it all together, because you want your coaches and the general manager to have confidence in you. So you learn how to hide really well. And I think that there are probably a lot of Christians who feel like, I also need to look the part. This is what it looks like to be a successful Christian. It means that you don't struggle with X, Y, and Z. And the reality is that all of us are struggling in some way. And one story that I talk about in there is the man who had the withered hand in Mark chapter 3. This guy probably lived his entire life insanely aware of his disability. And when I was in high school, I had really, really bad acne. I had to take Accutane for 5 months, and it destroyed my self-esteem. I felt like anytime I walked into a room, everybody saw this ugly, hideous beast. And because my sense of self-esteem was so low, like, that caused me to go and look in all these other areas. And so I can relate to how this guy in Mark chapter 3 probably felt. And Jesus walks in there, and all the religious people have no compassion on this guy. They have no interest in helping this guy. And Jesus says, stretch out your hand to this guy who has a withered hand. Which this guy with the withered hand is probably like, thanks, Jesus. Like, let's just talk about this in front of everybody, this thing I feel so inadequate and ashamed of. And Jesus says, stretch out your hand. I want you to show me that thing that makes you feel inadequate. Show that to me. Stretch it out. And when he does, it says, and it was restored as whole as the other. Because that guy had the courage to show somebody the thing that made him feel ashamed, he was made whole. And all of us have those things. What are the things that make you feel ashamed? If you can have the courage to walk in vulnerability and with trusted community and talk about the things that make you feel inadequate, man, those things are going to lose its power in your life, and you're really going to like who you are. but it takes courage and it takes trusting the process and it takes engaging with people and having the humility to be vulnerable with people that you trust.
So what's next?
We are in full steam getting this thing launched out to the world, and it's been a really, really exciting process. I've got a ton of speaking events all over the place promoting that. And I think that it's a message that a lot of people are going to hear their voice when they read it. It's going to help them put words to the things that have been in their heart about overcoming their own stories and fears and inadequacies, and helping them identify the false fathers that they look to for a sense of significance. And so I want to keep writing and speaking. I love what I'm doing now. And it's been fun to just kind of create a sense of hope for a whole lot of people.
So as you lay now in bed at night, and I took you back to those dorm room in Oklahoma and through TCU and as a Seattle Seahawk and everything else, as you lay now at night, do you have a sense of peace?
I have such a sense of peace. It's unbelievable. And I didn't for a long time. And I want to be able to sleep in the middle of a storm like Jesus did. But a lot of times I identify with the disciples and I'm like, Jesus, don't you care that I'm dying? And now that I am out of the storm, I can see God's providence and God's hand in everything that I was doing. And whatever the storm is that people are going through, from somebody who felt like he's been in a storm his whole life, I just want to encourage people that, man, God's with you. And get into the Word and find out what he has to say and renew your mind and spend time with him and be vulnerable with people, because the only way that we really become whole is with people. Mm. If you want to find your purpose, you got to find your people. So, if you want to find the reason that you belong on this world, you got to find the people to do life with. And that's going to take courage and vulnerability, which is so terrifying. I know people who can go out and play incredibly well just down the street from us at CenturyLink Field. But the idea of sharing something that makes you feel inadequate, that's the most terrifying thing in the world. The bravest person that I know is somebody who has the courage to take their withered hand and say, hey, I want you to look at this. And when you do, it'll be made whole.
Clint, it's beautiful that the Lord had you in this sensitive, insecure, beautiful heart playing in the most physical, violent, masculine, testosterone-filled game. And you ever just look back and go, man, what? Not only an amazing God, what a God of some humor, too.
Man, seriously. In looking back, it feels so much more tedious. Yeah. Like, gosh, I cannot believe that I made it out with my life. Man, you know, there were so many times where I felt like, I don't belong here. Like, I am just not on the same wavelength as some of these guys. And it was good for me because it helped me understand how to reach people that are different from me. And I think that especially in Christian culture, we want to get into our bubble and we want to feel safe and we want to feel and be around people that are just like us. Mm. And Jesus tells us to love our neighbor as ourselves. Your neighbor is not always going to be just like you. Your neighbor is not always going to vote for the same person. Your neighbor is not always going to have the same skin tone as you. And so what does it look like to love people who are different? Well, that means that you need to get out of your comfort zone and be around people who are different from you. Mm-hmm. And now that I've done that, now that I've spent 6 years with people who I otherwise would have never spent any time with, just because that's how we are, I have such a greater sense of the love of God and how big he is and his purpose for reaching everybody that I wouldn't have had I not had those seasons with the Seahawks.